everybody, and welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, brought to you by Cyence Technologies. We interview outbound leaders at fast growth businesses to learn their secrets and bring you actionable insights. Thanks for joining us this week.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Enterprise Sales Development. I'm your host, Eric Quanstrom, the CMO at Cyence. Today's episode, we had Alan, well, the Americanized pronunciation would be Versteeg, but as a South African, I trained for this a little bit. It's pronounced Versteeg. And you'll hear us go over my pronunciation. I think I got it even more right during the interview recording. At any rate, you're going to want to listen to Alan. And boy, oh boy, was this a fun discussion. We covered a ton of topics. We delved deep into sales, why they happen, why they don't. Alan is the chief revenue officer at Growth Matters, which is essentially a sales consultancy. And they really specialize in helping sales managers achieve their goals. So we deconstruct the sales process. We talk about Sherpas. Oh my gosh, so much fun. There's so many like what I call nuggets and takeaways from this particular interview. You're going to want to listen. And by the way, there is not a dull moment. We're both fast talkers, Alan and I. So ultimately, this is as packed of an episode with chock full of goodness as frankly we've ever done. And so, you know, from beginning to end, I find this conversation was fascinating. Hopefully you will agree. And without further ado, let's get to it. Here is Alan Versteeg. And so we're back with Alan V. Now, overseas, you said that people pronounce it Versteeg, and you're fine with that, but Versteeg. Did I come close?
That's correct. That's actually much closer to accurate because that's more of the Dutch pronunciation, which is its origin. In South Africa, it's Versteeg, so it's a bit rougher. But Versteeg is actually the Dutch way. So very good there, Eric. Well done.
I'm gaining points right off the bat here with this interview. Well, Alan, you've got quite an interesting background, you know, being the chief revenue officer of Growth Matters and really catering to and helping kind of sales teams grow and their sales managers thrive. You didn't always start in sales. In fact, that wasn't even your upbringing, you know, kind of coming up through the ranks. Tell us a little bit about how an engineer meets sales and where we go from there.
Yeah, spot on. So I was an only son, three sisters. My dad was an engineer and his father was an engineer. It's a Dutch heritage. Unfortunately, I lost my dad at 12. Oof. But having grown up watching Airwolf, Knight Rider and MacGyver, electronic engineering seemed like the way to go, right? It looked like an entertaining career.
I can hear kids' voice in the background.
Yeah. And I studied that and I was really good at my studies and I understood the subject. But about 2 years into the career, I read a book by, I think it's John Mason, called You're Born an Original, Don't Die a Copy. Mm. And it's a wonderful book for those of you that aren't readers because every chapter is 2 pages. So it's a good way to get into reading. And he said, if you passionately hate what you're doing for 2 weeks, stop. No matter what it is. And I'm like, 2 weeks? This has been 2 years. And unlike what was advertised on the box, the Airwolf, the Knight Rider, and MacGyver, I was cleaning cockroaches out of banking terminals, and I wasn't enjoying the job. But the biggest part was I felt isolated. I felt separated from human beings. So I quit. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. Fortunately, I'd done well enough for a bursary to cover my education. And a friend of mine said, why don't you try sales? You seem like you're good with people. That's what you're looking for. And I said, well, this seems to make sense. And then I asked your listeners not to drop off now. But got fired from my first 4 sales jobs. And my frustration, Eric, was I was doing everything they were telling me to do. You know, they said you needed to know your product. I'd get 99.9% on my product knowledge tests. And what I like to say now is I was the world's best talking brochure. And then they said, Alan, you know, you're not motivated enough. I got so excited you could weld with me. But I just became a highly motivated world's best talking brochure. And I couldn't crack through. And you must understand, I've got 3 sisters and a mom. Hollywood doesn't do a great job of portraying the sales profession. And everyone's telling me to get back into engineering. And I worked under a manager, Eric, that changed my life. And he said these words to me. He said, Alan, is sales a job or is it a profession? So I said, for me, it's a profession. He says, how hard have you studied for this profession? And I kind of had that drop moment. And I said, Not really. He said, how hard did you study to be an engineer? I said, I studied my ass off. You know, it was a lot of work. He says, okay, well, if it's a profession, that's what you got to do. And he quoted someone, and Eric, I forget who, but he said, why is it that we think Olympic athletes need to study a practice a lifetime for a moment of glory? And in sales, we think we can practice for a moment, never lifetime glory. And that moment pivoted something in my brain. I chose sales as my career, became my passion, became good at sales, eventually owned the African license for spin selling, Neil Rackham's work. And then my second change was I realized that training wasn't driving an impact because we weren't working with sales managers. We were taking top performers, putting them into a sales manager role without a system in place to prepare them. And unfortunately, at that time, technology coming in, sales managers moved behind the mouse and forgetting that those key disciplines of frontline sales management. So that, in a very abbreviated version, Eric, is my journey to here. And now blessed, we train managers around the country. Obviously, when COVID hits, I thought, what are we going to do? My job is to get on the plane, fly to countries and educate people. But all of our customers stayed on board. We rebuilt the content for virtual. And I think in the last 2 years, we've trained over 1,000 managers in 49 countries.
Wow.
We've been blessed in that space because we believe that if you unlock the potential of the manager, you can change the family trees of the sales professional because you really unlock the potential. And that's our backstory in a nutshell.
Wow, that was really well told, almost like perfectly packaged. borderline walking brochure. It's such a great story.
I have a good talking brochure, right?
Yeah, well, hey, those with a gift of gab tend to gravitate towards sales and get, you know, kind of like into those roles in the first place. I love that Olympic quote too. I think that is so spot on, right? Like leveling up the profession is kind of like a noble goal. One that probably never ends, does it?
Yeah. Well, it isn't. And think about this, Eric. We say lawyers are practicing, doctors are practicing. So when you speak about any profession, it's supported by a mechanism called practicing. Yeah. And as sales, we have to take ownership of our careers, understand we're practicing. I know as you do these podcasts and go through your journey, you're learning all the time, but you're only learning if you're open to the learning. And that happens when you treat it as a profession. We're always practicing. And getting better and better as a result.
So do you think that any good training regimen starts with essentially learning how to learn or being open to learn?
Yeah, I mean, there's enough research on that. So Carol Dweck's work on mindset and the growth mindset and being curious about where you got to go to is so critical because the fixed mindset, we limit ourselves around it. And I don't think it's just a sales success. I mean, just coming back to your comment, Eric, on gift of the gap, the data says that there's a 0.003% difference of predictable sales success between an introvert and an extrovert, right? So basically, it's negligible. The difference is a word you used just now. It's nobility. When we sell with noble purpose, when we know that selling won't help and helping will sell, when we have the right intentions and we show up, we don't rock up, we differentiate ourselves in the market. And you don't have to worry about methodology, you know, tonality and all those, that's better golf clubs for your game. Mm-hmm. But when your intention is right, you're there. And Lisa Earl McLeod wrote a book called Selling with Noble Purpose. If you ever can, try get her as a guest. But effectively what she said was making a difference and making a living are not mutually exclusive. And it's that mindset, that nobility that really drives our change. And then the growth mindset, as you lead it to, that says, that sets me on a completely different trajectory, you know? And without hijacking that point, but a key thing you've said there is when COVID hit, you know, I was licking my wounds. I'm going, what do I do? You get highly introverted. And my growth mindset said, how do you be the most relevant call they've had that week? Meaning at the end of a week, when they've got Zoom fatigue and meeting fatigue, they remember Al. And they remember, man, that was an engaging meeting. And that design point changed how I prepared myself for a virtual sales world. And then blessed, Eric, because now I could sell international deals from this camera.
Yeah, right. And you can be
but
everywhere.
It's a great mindset.
At the same time. Yeah, blessing and a curse, right? Like, especially for folks that had been really good in person, dynamic, you know, used to kind of like that form factor, all just being switched up on the fly.
Yeah, but you think about it, Eric, and this is where we've got to be very careful how much the message and the messenger remain the same. Mm-hmm. The medium changes. And that's the key thing. A lot of companies saying, no, salespeople don't know how to sell virtually. I'm saying, well, before you have that question, let's ask the question, do they know how to sell? Do you have a skilled messenger with a compelling message? So, you know, in your role as the chief marketing officer, you've got to get really good at that message to market and make sure we've got good messengers delivering it. Now, whether that's face-to-face, in-person, via a podcast, or on a camera, that's a medium. And I think that's often when COVID hit, everyone got panicky about medium. And I'm going, keep your message relevant and get used to the medium. It's hard, but get used to it, you know?
Well, you know, in prospecting and sales development, I think that we've all kind of adopted the mantra that multi-channel is the most effective strategy that we can employ. But each channel is completely different from one another, especially with strategies. Do you see it similarly?
100%. And I mean, why I'm excited about the work your team does, the way I see it is it's content container channel. And what I tend to see is everyone debating the channels. And I'm with you. You know, military talks about force multiplier effect. You got to have a force multiplier effect. But that starts with relevant content that creates value for the audience. Then the container is that a blog? Is that a podcast? Is that a video? Is that a white paper? But then channel, you want to maximize channel. So I fully buy into that. And I think there's so many debates we get into, Eric, that are futile exercises in intelligence. You know, don't debate the market. Go get out there and practice, because you learn by doing and you only hit speed bumps by moving.
Yeah, that's for sure. And you know, our practice in the sales development world, you know, we can look at every connected call, every email that we're sending to a, you know, complete stranger and potentially interrupting their day. All of those are essentially our practice runs, aren't they?
Yeah, it's exactly that. And the key thing is the practice. Remember, practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. What's so critical is that reflection, that checkup from the neck up. Because what we tend to see, and I mean, Eric, I'm preaching to the expert here, but is people get so debated on the channels and they don't get what's the lesson we take from this about our message.
Yeah.
Because when you're interrupting someone's day, relevance is the currency of value. So you can start to fine-tune the message, fine-tune the things. And that's where the technology and, you know, what your organization does, I think, is so powerful. Because what will take me 2 years to learn, technology can learn in 2 weeks.
Right.
But it doesn't help if I'm deploying an irrelevant message of look at me across those platforms.
Yep. Yeah. One of the habits that we always are very strongly into with every SDR and every coaching session, every training opportunity that we have is the healthiest habit is it's not about you and leading with the prospect and never forgetting that, largely because then it resequences everything that follows properly. You know, people don't care about you, your company, your solution, your product until they have reason to. And relevance is the gateway to opening that door, is it not?
100%. And I mean, using language, we use slightly different, but it's you got to educate then demonstrate. So you never speak your value proposition, meaning you don't say, I don't have to talk my capability, I demonstrate it by the nature and how I behave and how I communicate. And exactly what you said there, let's first educate. So what's the problem? What's the perspective? And let's meet them. What's the punchline? Let's meet them there. And only when they bought into that, do they then think about, you know, how are you going to help me fix this? Is your company the right partner? Is it going to be worth the effort? We tend to lead on the other side. We tend to lead with the path and the proof. You know, and the metaphor I always see, Eric, is walking into a bar and sliding your Porsche keys across the bar and saying, here I am. And wondering why the customer's ghosting you because they think you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Right? You got to lead with value. What I will say is it doesn't mean we're not the price. It means we've got to value our value and do the heavy lifting of making that relevant. Because customers say that 53% is their engagement with us.
Right.
So the better we show up, the better we differentiate.
Well, and that's so true once you get into mid or late funnel, where ultimately the sales cycle and win rates are really around, much more than I think most people believe, the behaviors, the synthesis of information, the value that's provided by the salesperson.
100% right. And it's ironic, Eric, because I'm hearing terms now like human to human selling. I'm like, have you been asleep at the wheel? I mean, we are human beings selling to human beings. We're not human doings selling to human doings. And it's exactly that piece. It's the and. It's not the or. It's not salespeople or technology. It's not salespeople or ChatGPT. It's not salespeople or AI. It's about how do I get that to enhance what I'm trying to do when my intent is value creation upfront? Because remember, most of sales, Eric, people are saying it's all about relationships. I'm going, yeah, but relationships you don't manufacture. Relationships are the reward for value delivered. you can't wait until you sell something to deliver value. You can't wait for the product to deliver the value. You can't wait for the service to deliver the value. You have to deliver value in the sales exchange.
Yes.
So you would be you're going to be focused on that during the process. And when you add value, you get moved along the organization. And that's for me is the sales process. Add value to this person at this point, continue. The rest will take care of itself, but that's your intent. But so often we're going to prove the value after the fact. And I'm like, it's flawed. Let's be relevant and value creating now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really healthy way of looking at things, I think, that that doesn't get you distracted. And, you know, it's funny too, because I see a lot of people go wrong where they think relationship has to start with the personal, or they have to start kind of like in a weird, like relationship building way, as opposed to talking about like the area of focus for the product, service, or company that you're with.
Yeah, it's such a key point. And I think, once again, I mean, the engineer in me gets fascinated by this because relationship is an outcome. It's the reward for value delivery. So when we understand that, we don't go, well, let me try and manufacture a relationship. Let me try and understand what Eric's interests are. And let's say your interests are American football. Now I'm going to speak about that and I'm going to look like an idiot because I don't know what I'm talking about.
Right.
And most importantly, authenticity accelerates trust. When we're trying to be something, we're not manufacture relationships. We're never authentic. We know this in our personal lives when we were young men pursuing the market. You know, it's like the minute you're trying to be something you're not, at some point that mask comes down and you go, what's wrong with this situation? Well, because you can't manufacture the relationship with authenticity. Have noble purpose, have the value centered, do that. Always, you know, have your growth mindset, do your checkup from the neck up, have a good coach that's helping you, and then leverage technology. But don't try and manufacture relationships. Don't get me wrong, relationships grease the wheels of deals once you've delivered the value. But during that time, make sure that every call, every engagement, they take away something beneficial to them.
Well, I think one of the hard skills, tell me if you agree with this assessment. I think one of the hard skills is, you know, Dale Carnegie said something to this extent about 100 years ago, interested is interesting. And the hard skill is really around becoming interested in the role, the KPIs, the goals, the familiar problems and pain points of the person you're talking to, and really like trying to understand their world, walking a mile in their shoes, so to speak, when that's not our job, you know, as SDRs or as people reaching out to cold net new clients or contacts.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it tough.
It is. And unfortunately, Eric, is the organizational cultures don't support the exact behaviors they say they value. So we don't have conversations around how are we engineering relevance into this conversation. We don't have conversations about what specifically in the customer's business will change the result in working with us. We ask about where are you at? What are you on with your quota? Are you doing next? What's your ratios? Now that's management. That's not development and coaching. Yes, that has a place in sales, of course. But I've tended to see a sway in, we say we want to be customer focused and centric and value creating, but everything in the organizational culture is only about the quarter. And I'm going, guys, you've got to find an and balance here. When I train sales managers, I'm going, you know, the reality is you're focusing on one outcome. What gets us there? And you know, Eric, you're saying these things and they're so, you know, when you say them and it's like, say, a 100-year-old book, you're going, well, that makes sense. Why is common sense not common practice? Well, because we don't reward the right behavior. We don't go, wait a minute, what does this look like? And in your role, you know, with all the organizations you work with, it's message. We've got to get that message right. And then the authenticity of the messenger. But what makes it hard is we're driven by an activity as opposed to an outcome, which is value creation. So when I'm thinking about value, and I want you to think about what I said earlier about profession and practicing, you really want the guys about to cut your chest open to know you, right? Or lady, for that matter. You want them to know you. Why do we think we can interrupt people's day and have taken no time to engineer a relevant opening statement? Where's our right? And then we call it cold calling. It's cold calling because we're going in cold.
Right.
It's proactive sales calling. Mark Weinberg says it so well. Proactive sales calling. Because I'm proactive, which means I prepare. I don't rock up. I don't rock up, I show up. And I think that's what makes it hard, Eric, is we don't protect the time to set ourselves up for success. So we rock up and we hope, and then it becomes a numbers game. But end of the day, and please go with me on this one, Eric. This is what I say to sales managers. Hey guys, listen here, selling is a numbers game. And you know, listen here, Al, I've been looking at your numbers and you see 10 clients a week and you get 2 sales and you're about half on your target. So you need to go see 20 customers. What the manager's saying is, Alan, you suck. Why don't you go suck twice as often in front of twice as many prospects?
Right.
We damage our brains. Yeah. And I'm being extremely obvious, Eric, but we're damaging our brain. We got to understand the importance of coaching, as you said, those SDRs, those checkup from the neck ups, those growth mindsets, and setting us up for that success. And then obviously manage the numbers. But we can't expect common sense to be common practice when we don't make it common culture in our sales organization.
Well, you know, I think that that statement, and I will go with you, when you say numbers game, it almost always is the first number at the top of the funnel that gets focused on, rather than the number that really pays, which is conversion rate, to be measured at the bottom of whatever funnel you want to look at, right? So the way we might even look at that with SDRs or prospectors or people that are opening sales conversations rather than closing a deal would be something like, well, how many call connects did you have and how many of those turned into positive next conversations, AKA meetings or appointments?
Yeah.
And looking at those ratios.
It's a verifiable step in the process. And I mean, if you look at yours, you know, you've got the people, the products, and the process. And in your process, you've got the OKRs and the KPIs. That's important because if you're not, you know, the only reason we measure something is to improve it. And if you're measuring the wrong things, you're improving the wrong things. And that's the challenge you got to understand. The other thing I'd say, in my view, in the lead generation outbound process, it's a funnel. But in sales, it's a pipeline. Because funnel has gravity. Things go in and things come out. Pipelines require inspection, maintenance, all of those things. So the minute you get into that sales conversation, you got to shift that mindset and say to organizations, it's not about putting more in the front and getting more out. It's about optimizing the pipeline. Funnel's different. You know this, Eric. I've got to reach out to a certain breadth of audience to get a certain bunch of verifiable meetings that are the right ones. Because once again, the metric is I can go speak to 50 of the wrong people.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll give you an example. I decided I wanted to get myself out there. So I signed up a bunch of organizations to get me onto podcast. And I'd argue, Eric, that 80% of them are the wrong audience and the wrong podcast. But guess what? As Gary Vaynerchuk says, I'm out there creating content. You know what I mean? And this is the stuff you've got to debate. Now we'll look at the metrics and say, my next cycle, I'm choosing a stronger partner. I'm choosing a different thing. And I get an incremental improvement where most people stand around there going, well, is someone going to send me leads? I'm going, irrelevant in the market. You know, so I love what you're sharing because those metrics, that's why I loved your thing as those three Ps. The process of measurement is so critical because otherwise you go, oh, this thing's failing. And you're tweaking the wrong mechanism.
Yeah. I really like the way that you're turning it, you know, a funnel on its side, because it is mistaken to believe that any prospect, I've always said, this is my own little thesis statement, if you will, as a CMO, and I believe this pretty much my whole career, that it's actually harder to buy than it is to sell, believe it or not. It's fraught with more emotion, more peril for making the wrong choice, indecision, lack of like sophistication in all but the biggest companies.
Internal complexity, political plays within the organization. You're 100%. I love that.
Information asymmetry or overload as another huge variable. But if you're using a funnel analogy and you're expecting people to pop out the bottom, you're assuming that they want to go through a process to a change, right? Because ultimately, every sale is a change, is it not? Like if there's no sale, there's no change in the status quo of whatever that organization, those people within it, the buying group, if you will. Wanted to see on the other side of that change, right? Because they're going to commit money to, a product solution or service in order to do some sort of job, in order to get some sort of goal, to reach some sort of change state. And so assuming that people are just going to fall out the bottom of a funnel because they're in it. it's crazy, isn't it?
It's flawed thinking. You know? And then let's look at some of the toughest statistics. I think the most recent, but Gartner said that 67% of qualified opportunities end in no decision.
Yeah.
That means status quo is your number one competitor. Stop worrying about everyone else.
Always.
The inability to act is the problem. And exactly what you said, because buying is hard. Our job is to guide them I like to use the word Sherpa, to Sherpa them through their buying journey so that they can meet that internal resistance to change. Because they want the outcome. But we've been there in sales. We've got to do this. It's urgent. Okay, nothing happens. We're going, what did I do wrong? And then if we only look at it as a funnel, then we're going, why didn't stuff pop out at the bottom? It must be a salesperson problem. But did we target the right audience with the right message at the right time in their buying process? I don't know. And so there's a better metrics. And that's, once again, just want to come back to the strength of your process. You're not throwing a product in the market. You say it's the people, the SDRs. There's all your go versions of your products. But part of that is to say, what are we measuring here, guys? And what are we trying to improve? Because we don't know that we don't improve.
I love what you're saying. And I really like the idea of using the Sherpa as an analogy, because Sherpas, for those that aren't familiar with the term, are both a people, Nepalese typically, and it stands for, the word means guide, literally in the dictionary definition. And if you think about, like, you know, the most famous Sherpas in the world, the Tenzings, if you will, that helped.
Okay,
lead the first expedition to summiting Mount Everest, the tallest mountain in the world. What is it that a Sherpa has to do, right? Like, they have to understand a mountain, B, understand like the terrain, like when to scale a mountain, when not to, when to pitch base camp, when not to, how to like handle the conditions when you're existing as a human at like what, half the air capacity of normal ground or sea level. Yep. Understanding certain routes are better than others, guiding those with which you have the lives of those people in your hand. So, you know, in business, it's not quite life and death, but we can take that analogy a step further and think about like, well, how are we guiding anyone towards a sale or towards the outcome that they want, which, you know, metaphorically speaking, could be summiting a mountain.
Hold on. And I mean, if we take exactly that, Eric, and add a couple of things on. One, Sherpas of today leverage technology, but they don't only rely on technology. So, you know, once again, the technology stack is an enabler of improved performance, but there's nuances the Sherpa knows that technology can't explain. And I think, you know, a word that also helped me kind of do my next 10X jump was someone said to me, Alan, you need to give yourself agency, which is give yourself permission for the value you want to create. And I think sometimes with sales professionals, Eric, is we don't respect that we've been up and down that mountain 100 times. We don't respect how much insights and experience and value we can bring to the conversation. So we don't give ourselves the agency to do that. So when you take on that Sherpa thing, also take on the I am the prize. And the I am the prize isn't the, you know, sliding the Porsche keys across things, saying, I can guide you in stuff you don't know. I can help you navigate the alternatives, avoid potential pitfalls and landmines, give you some market perspectives, educate you on issues. I'm there to support you. And the language I use, it actually comes from a book called B4B Selling. But I use all the time is selling won't help, but helping will sell. And when they have that mindset, everything changes. And then those behaviors that want to come out come from that value system, that noble value system. And that's the key thing. I love that you picked up on that, because knowing what to do, but giving yourself the agency to be the guide is how you show up. And when you show up with that, people resonate with you because they're going, Al's trying to help me do this complex journey. Al's trying to help me navigate my internal challenges. Al's trying to help me. And they rely on you. And sometimes they don't buy from you, Eric. But let me tell you, they follow me on my podcast. They go to my site. They're an audience. And that's the value I can give.
Yeah, I love that. And helping will sell. Because, again, back to the Sherpa example, I also think it's a nice forcing function for thinking through what actually is a sale. You know what I mean? Like where we're helping people realize a better version of themselves or, again, get a job done that they were doing in a way that was like less than suboptimal, not as good prior to, you know, coming together with, again, your company.
Yeah, spot on. And what you said is if I take that metaphor is, you know, the customer is the hero in the story. But if you think about what happened with Tenzing and Sir Edmund Hillary is when they got to the top and Tenzing said summit. Sir Edmund Hillary wasn't sure that Edmund Hillary said, no, you're with me. And the first photo taken on the summit was the two of them together. Because of, you know, the way the world was back then, he was not recognized till 20 years later. But at no point in any interview did Sir Edmund Leary say, I summited. He always said we. And I want you to think about in the sales example, your customers will automatically give you references and recognize your part in their journey when you're the Sherpa. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's how you scale, because value creates value, which creates value, which creates value. So I love that piece that you've said, because they'll bring you along and they'll say, Alan made me the hero. Alan made me look good in my role. Alan made me whatever. The organization technology or solution did actually, but it's in that journey that they stuck. Yeah. That's why I love your mindset. Buying is harder than selling. And when we become empathetic buyer enablers, Sherpas, things change.
Yeah, that empathy piece is a really strong one. Do you find that that's difficult to train and teach and coach into, you know, I don't want to say rank and file, but like into kind of like sales managers?
And I'm going to answer you in two ways. So it's difficult to train unless, and the unless part is unless you have a framework. The problem with most training, Eric, is we're teaching people how to do stuff. We don't know how to do, we don't need to be taught how to do stuff. We need to elevate our thinking frameworks and our guideline processes. That's what we need. So when you have a framework, for example, in our framework, we're saying, you know, you say salespeople go research customers. I'm saying, no, this is what you need to say. Who are they? What are they trying to achieve? What stands in their way? What have they done before? What is the unique perspective you're going to educate them on? What do we have? What changes? What do they get? Why are they scared to change? What's the cost of not changing? 11 blocks of a framework. Now what happens is I've got that ability. So when we have frameworks, the problem is most people, the brain's an amazing thing, but it is everywhere unless it has frameworks. It loves pigeonholes. And this isn't just engineering, Eric. This is the brain, right? But the minute I give it that thing, I say, okay, great, that's what it is. And then from there, you can turn it into a narrative. You know, I've recently been working with people like you in industries like yours who have been trying to achieve this, but struggling to because of this. And many times they've tried to fix it this way. But what they fail to see is that technology alone doesn't fix this. What you effectively need is you need people, you need process, and you need the right product collectively working together. And by the way, what we have is our model called the Go model, which changes this so you can get this outcome. I know you're weary to invest in this because of cost to lead, but we have demonstrated what it would cost if you employ the service yourself. So not changing is a higher risk because your customer acquisition budget is actually going to go down. That's easy for me to spit out of my head without really knowing your business, Eric. I have a framework. Yeah. What I tend to see we're doing with adults is we think we can teach them stuff that we're going to become irrelevant with AI and all the other stuff in that space. Yeah. Where we have relevance is the ability to educate thinking. So I don't think it's hard when we give people frameworks, but I get frustrated with the should managers. I call them that you're shooting all over people. Should do this and you should do this and you should do this. You know, give them a framework. Tell me the how. I mean, just but give me a framework because Alan's got to be authentic. Eric, you're going to take that framework in that process, much like you'll take ingredients in a recipe, and you're going to build something, you're going to create something that's Eric's, right? Similar to mine, but Eric's. And I'm going to do the same. But right. we keep telling people what the meal should look like, but we don't give them the ingredients in the recipe. So, I mean, I can go for hours down this stuff, but frameworks are powerful. And yeah. You know this, if I just look at it, once again, I just want to compliment you, but if you look at your website, it is a framework of buying navigation. I mean, I'm going to steal it eyes wide open. So just so you know, I'm not ashamed to tell you, I'm going to steal it because when I was on your site, the way it navigates me through my complex journey of buying is phenomenal. That's before I've engaged with one of your SDRs. This is what it is. So I think it served you well that your mindset is buying is tougher. And if what I am is I'm a buying enabler, man, empathy happens because we understand what is it that they're not seeing and what perspective can I give them to be the Sherpa, to be the Obi-Wan Kenobi, to be the Yoda, whatever you want to call it in that space.
Yeah. Well, and also because back to that notion of buying tougher than selling, one of the most inescapable trends that I've observed over the last, frankly, few decades is that buying is a consensus activity in B2B. It's not a sole, we use the word decision maker all the time. And yet I have been part, every time I've been part of the corporate landscape in any buy cycle, there's never been one person making any decision.
Ever. I mean, I banned this word. My customer's saying, if you're using that language, it demonstrates your lack of maturity in sales. It's a buying committee.
Right.
Right. Or a buying board or whatever you want to call it. Buying. But who's the person that signs the check? Because the person who signs the check has no clue what problem we're fixing.
Right.
Right. But they're an influencer as part of that committee. Yes. But this decision-maker concept means we were asleep at the wheel, Eric, with respect, because it's an easy should statement. You know, I hear you, Albert. Are you speaking to the decision maker? Well, please come with me to the customer and point her out. Because let me tell you, I can't find her. Oh, no, it's that person who signs the check. She doesn't even know what we do. Right. She just wants to have a good business case for change, which is what I love about your lead ROI calculators. That's what she needs. Okay, that's what her requirement of value is. Yeah. If this person gets fired, me, the CRO, I get fired when the pipeline isn't healthy to drive our goals for 2024. Your job as your business, Eric, is to help me figure out, using your science, I love the brand as well, the science, to help me figure out how I meet my goal. And if your SDR doesn't get me comfortable that I'm doing that, I can't position that to my partner. I can't position that to my sales team. And I'm not going to buy. And I'm not going to buy because I don't like you or the person. I'm not going to buy because I am forced to connect the dots on value. It's your job to help me connect those dots on value.
Well, and back to your stat earlier, which I totally agree with, and I'm not surprised by one bit, 67% of deals ending in no decision could be just as simple as, yeah, I couldn't defend the value internally. Yeah, I couldn't find the business case. Oh, I couldn't champion this person or this purchase to the people that were asking hard questions around why spend the money? Why do things different?
Oh, true. So, and I've got to share a story because I think it's good for your listeners. But when I started out in sales in this space, I used to sell to sales managers and human resources. And I'd be a good success rate and conversion ratio on sales managers, pretty weak on human resources. I used to call them the human resistance department. I couldn't figure out. And the point was, I didn't understand what relevance looked like to them. And you see, what you're saying is so true, is that a lot of salespeople say to me, oh, but they're blocking me. They're not giving me access higher. What's the tactic I can use? I say to them, I've never, ever had to ask for access higher. When you present value in that moment and they can see the Sherpa, these are the words they use. Eric, I need to get you in front of.
Yes.
They use that. I don't have to prompt them because they know I've helped them navigate something and paint a picture in their brain, and they're going to trust me to go take that one level up. And I, you guys, please listen here. I'm in the East Rand of South Africa. And I'm winning global deals, not because I was born this way. Remember, I got fired from my job. I'm doing this because in every conversation, I show up with what's the value I can deliver to this person. And they start to introduce me to the buying committee. And by the way, Eric, you know this. They don't always know who they are.
Yeah.
They're figuring out as we progress, oh, I should actually bring Sarah into this. And I need to bring Jules into this. And now, but they got you as their trusted advisor before I've sold a single thing and delivered a day of product value.
Well, you know, what you're describing, at least to my ears, is exactly what makes a salesperson a professional, engaged in a practice, is learning, you know, all the intricacies, the special snowflake details of that particular organization as a would-be customer and kind of shepherding that process all the way along. Am I wrong in that?
No, you're 100% right. And when I take frameworks and I build it back, because I'm an engineer in me, I'm blessed that I can build frameworks. My father was an engineer. My mother was an artist. My grandmother was an English teacher. My grandfather was a businessman. So I've got great DNA. I'm blessed. You know, I'm not denying I hit the DNA lottery. But that allows me to build frameworks. And if you think about the framework I share with you, here's the key thing. Every customer, regardless of role, is asking four questions. Do you know me and understand my business? Is there value in me changing? Is there value in me choosing you as their partner? And is there value in me doing that now?
Yeah.
Those are the four things. And you know, as a young salesperson, I've got the first two good. I know you and understand your business, and there's value in changing. But guess what? I wouldn't differentiate. So now they go buy a competitor's product for a problem I educated them on. So I had to differentiate. Why us? Then I couldn't understand it. I've answered the why, you know, why you, I know your business. I've answered the why change. I've answered the why us. Why are they not buying? Why is there this delay? Well, the last one is why now? We don't create that urgency to change. That's exactly what you're saying. I love the word snowflakes. It's those intricacies of, wait a minute, am I meeting them where they're at? Because their brain, there's a lot of noise in there. But the key thing is, do you know me and understand my business, or are you trying to dump something on me? Is there really value in me changing? Or is that just your pitch because you're under quota? Are you the right company, or are you just saying the same stuff? Oh, no, we have great products. We have good people. Because I've never seen a competitor, by the way, Eric, put on their proposal, we hire mediocre people at a mediocre rate for mediocre work. I've never seen it. It might be true, but they've never said it, right? So we don't differentiate. But then the point we've...
Marketers don't let that out the door, by the way.
Yeah. The final thing is this, Eric. The final barrier to change is internal psychology. It's the fear of change.
Yeah.
It's not making the cost of doing nothing clear. And that's that piece, that last one, why change now? We have to get there and say, wait a minute. Let's remind you of the cost of doing nothing versus the sacrifice for change. And when we start piecing that together, we win more deals. And the point is, in my pipeline, My closing ratio in stage 4 or 5 is at 80%. But then I know I'm winning the deal. I lose because either budgetary timing or occasionally, probably 1 in 15 to a competitor. The mid tier, we've got about a 50% because in the beginning, I'm adding value. And I'm also disqualifying customers because I'm going, I'm not the right fit for you.
Right.
You know, I'm not the remuneration specialist. I'm not the specialist in SDR and go-to-market campaigns for inbound and outbound. You know, I'm a specialist in developing sales management executions in a business. So let me go play there. And because I build a healthy pipeline, I'm never selling out of desperation, you know, and we know this with our history. But, you know, for the sales professionals listening out there, what you got to do. For the sales managers, it's on you, because you got to create environments that support.
Yeah. Yeah. And constantly refine. And again, that word practice, I think, is the name of the game. Practice makes permanent, like you said earlier.
Yeah. That's it. And that's where coaching comes in, you know, because if practice makes permanent, not perfect, it means I need someone to help me. I need that measurement and feedback. I need that manager coaching me. And, you know, the story I use in our business is everyone's working on the enablement train and no one's laid the execution tracks because we don't develop execution disciplines in our managers. So we do that. We go, we're going to lay the execution track. Now, everything you're doing in enablement and training and technology and Salesforce.com and all of these other things have a place to go because we've worked with that execution discipline. But so often we don't. It's a hope and a prayer. And I think, you know, Eric, I don't know your world well enough, but if you had to do a post-mortem on where you lose deals, it's often the organization's disbelief that they can take the benefit. Not that what you do doesn't create benefit.
Right.
That they can't unblock it. I think a lot of my no's in the company go, Al, we're going to botch this up. And I've got to go, cool, I don't want you to botch up my brand. So let's figure out how we get you to a point where we don't feel that.
You know, that's a really insightful statement, because one of the things that's so hard to tease out in surveys or other postmortems is kind of like fear of failure, especially where it would reveal any of the participants to be vulnerable. Like, let's just call it what it is. And it, you know, we see it even on the other side of customers, where one of the reasons they've come to Cyence in the first place is other go-to-market channels haven't worked. You know, like they're not growing their pipeline through advertising or through inbound or through other means that if they were working great guns, they may not even be in our pipeline. You know, they may not even be customers.
Yeah. And it's so true you're saying that, because I just want to, you know, I mean, at the beginning of our connection, I'm saying, please get one of your SDRs to reach out to me. Because to be honest, Eric, I'm at that point where I'm going, with all my reading, with all my study, this is not my domain of excellence, and I'm getting frustrated. Now, right. You know, I don't know. And because of their frustration and past failure, I could easily go, is this really the right way to go? Or someone at Cyence guides me in that journey of discomfort and says, Al, this is how you start. Because Al immediately wants to go to the premium top range product you offer, because that's Alan's nature. And then my business partner is going to be, Al, hold back. How do we unlock the value initially? But we won't know how to navigate that if we were a potential customer of yours. And that's why it's so important that salespeople start to realize we are asking for help without saying, hey, guys, I'm stupid and I don't know what I'm doing. I need help. No one's going to say that. But it's the truth. I mean, I'm just being transparent of where I'm at and vulnerable. I don't know what I don't know, because I've never mastered the space. I've mastered my niche. So why wouldn't I partner and go, guys, but guess what? I'm fearful, because everyone, I mean, you know this, everyone in your space is the digital marketer. And everyone's the influence specialist. Everyone's the social guy. So you got all this noise that makes me more scared.
Yeah.
And that's why it's that guiding the buying journey where I'm going, this is someone I can trust. No, before I bought anything from you, this is someone I can trust.
Yeah.
And then guiding it. And it might end in a no sale because you realize it's not the right thing right now. But I'll never forget that experience. And if I'd say to you, of my pipeline, 30% is word of mouth, past stuff that's happening for the 10 years we've been in business. You can't put a price on it.
So true. And, you know, back to Sherpas, you know, the interesting part of using that as an analogy or a, you know, kind of a metaphor, Sherpas have this general recognition of it's going to be tough sledding. You're going to be in the snow. It's going to be really cold. The winds are going to howl, right? Like, you could fall. Like, everything's difficult, which is what makes for, I think, both a colorful story, but also, like, isn't that where, like, true trust is born? Acknowledging kind of like those difficult moments.
Sure, Eric. Yeah, I mean, you're a kindred spirit. I get so frustrated. I get so frustrated with objection handling training. Oh. Because that means you haven't shown empathy. What you've just said is exactly what I teach, which is you've got to lead with the objection yourself. I have had other customers in this position, and what has made them uncomfortable to change has been these things. However, what we've done to help them is this, because they realize that not changing is not an option. The cost of doing nothing is too high. But we don't. We teach these manufactured ways. And you want to be vulnerable saying, like the Sherpa, I mean, I love that. I've never used it. But that's what the Sherpa is saying. This is going to suck.
Yeah.
Eyes wide open. But guess what? I've got you. And I love that you share that. I think if we're not doing that, we're actually, and this is the key thing, that last sale we lose, the why now, we lose because of the internal dialogue of the buyer that they're not sharing, the internal fear. We need to bring that out. And when you say that, I mean, some of my opening slides are training fails. Why does it fail? Because it's not framework-led, it's not process-oriented, it's not executable. Cool. So now I'm positioning. And they're starting with going, I don't listen to this guy's going to sell me training. My first slide is saying training doesn't work. They're like, huh? What do you mean? Because it doesn't if you don't have these criteria. But if you do, this is what we can get done. And I love that you share that because I think we have to realize buyers are not only getting more savvy, but they're frustrated with the BS. They're frustrated with the pitch.
Yeah.
They just want to know you care.
Believe it or not,
behavior to demonstrate.
I completely agree. And you know, I'm going to indict my people. Marketers, we ruin everything. That's the known, because we want to put a happy spin or spin in general on everything. We want to position it. We want to not acknowledge necessarily like you said before, like how often do you ever sell or market or put on a website, like, you know, kind of like the negative realities that exist.
And why? And the thing is, we get in the initial world why that happened. But when you think about memorable moments in marketing, they are vulnerable. And if you've studied any of Brené Brown's work on Daring Greatly and the science of shame, and the story I love that she says is she's speaking at an event, and the person doing sign language says, "Is there a word you use a lot?" And she says, "I use the word vulnerability." And they said, "Well, this is the kind of global standard." She goes, "No, that's not what I mean." And then we get the news. And she said, no, that's not what I mean. Is there anything else? And she said, "There's only one other way, and it's this." And she says, "That's it." Because vulnerability is courage. Literally, before I call, I'm trying to get a rebate from Qantas. A flight during COVID, they got canceled. I got credits. I can't use it. It expires now. I go on the video from the CEO, dated 31st of August. He goes, "Guys, we screwed up this whole COVID thing. But let me tell you what we've done. No, a cutoff date for your credits. And if you want a refund, we'll give you a refund. This is the process you're going to follow. We know we messed it up. But a lot of other companies, their credits have already expired. There's no refund, whatever. We've listened to you. We should have listened sooner." Who doesn't go to take that Qantas brand and go, "No wonder I'm a platinum member here, because this is where I want to be." Because that's vulnerability. But most people say it's hard. Now, yes, you've got to doctor some words and you can't go, "Hey, we completely screwed up and I'm firing that guy." Right? Mm-hmm. But we got to realize this, that vulnerability is courage. And in sales, you know, it's there because people go, "I can trust this person because they don't try and be perfect."
Right.
And this is my biggest frustration. The energy we spend trying to be perfect is not only wasted energy, but detrimental to sales success because authenticity accelerates trust. And by authenticity, audience, I'm not saying because you're tattooed and you like to wear T-shirts and you swear a lot that's how you do. That's not what I mean. I mean, authentic intent of your profession, right? I'm here to serve. And that cuts a lot of the stuff away. And people go, I trust this person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. And boy, this was quite a tour de force interview. I really enjoyed it myself. Alan, for those that might need your services, might want to continue the conversation, where should they go?
Yeah, so the easiest place is one. I've got the most unique name in the world. Well, one of them. You've also got a very unique name, Eric. There's only one of us up in Alan. Versteeg, you'll find me, and you'll find me on LinkedIn. LinkedIn's a good place. For our company, it's Growth Matters INTL for international, growthmattersintl.com. And it's simply put, if you're reaching out, there's a lot of resources we have available that aren't in our core business, a lot of the conversation we had today. But where we play, Eric, is we develop sales managers so companies can deliver results. And we lay that execution track. That's what we do. So if that's relevant to your audience, reach out to us. Otherwise, lots of other free resources available on things like the Sherpa Canvas and, you know, how to build trust and those other areas that you spoke about today.
I love it. Thank you so much, Alan. It was a pleasure.
Excellent, Eric. Great. Thanks to you and thanks to the audience.